Side 8, Marl Fox by Brian Jakes. Continuing on page 351. A moment later, they were all out on the deck, soaking in the rain, gazing at the locked cabin door. Burble sighed. "Sure, and I wonder why 'tis that eagles don't have any sense of humor at all. We had to run for our lives there." McGraw sat alone in the locked cabin, muttering darkly. "Nay, beast speaks ill of Mither McGraw's egg chick. He'll stay oot in the elements until you apologize to me." Apart from the skies lowering darker a little, noon, twilight, and evening remained virtually the same, sheeting rain driving southward in heavy curtains over the lake surface as far as the eye could see, with a moderate wind spurring the raft ever onward toward the island. McGraw had been placated, but he deserted the cabin, choosing to stay on deck beneath a canvas awning, watching for sign of magpies. Gaujo lashed the tiller in position and joined his crew in the warm, cozy cabin, where a cheerful fire glowed within the pot-bellied stove. He lifted the lid from a cauldron, sniffing the simmering aroma. "By the seasons, that smells good and decent. What is it?" Dippler checked the contents, sprinkling in a pawful of sweet ground arrowroot to thicken up the sauce further. "That's a seagoing recipe, sir, called Skillion Duff. Logalog used to make it for the Gwasim when we followed the waters down to the great ocean." Torob hovered about the young shrew impatiently. "'Twill soon be ready, I trust." Dippler added more of the arrowroot and stirred it slowly. "Aye, soon now. The skilly is a thick, sweet sauce with all manner of good things in. That big puddin' floatin' about in it is the duff, stuffed with wild plums, damsons, blackberries, and chopped chestnuts, all cased up in a ball of spongy pastry, bit like a great dumplin'. Nothing like it to cheer up a body on a rainy old night, you'll see." The entire crew voted Dippler's skilly and duff delicious, some of the big hedgehogs noting down the recipe for use on winter nights. The Gwasim shrew recalled a comic seagoing monologue concerning the dish. "Aboard the good ship Wobblechop, I sailed when I was young, first in line and feeling fine when the dinner bell was rung. Our captain had a foghorn voice and boots as big as me. 'Stand by, me lads, here comes a ship. 'Tis a pirate craft,' cried he. Woe, Skillion Duff, that's the stuff to keep nearby when things get rough." The pirate captain was a rat. His name was Itchy Scratch. Upon his nose, why, goodness knows, he wore a red eye patch. "Haul to, you dozy lubbers. I'm fat and bad and tough, and I smells plunder on the air. What might be Skillion Duff? Woe, Skillion Duff, that's the stuff us water beasts can't get enough. Well, I tell you, me word is true, our crew got quite upset. To rob a sailor's dinner was the worst thing we'd heard yet. So we put down our bowls and spoons, then armed ourselves with slings. We slung at those old pirate rats a dozen kinds of things. Woe, Skillion Duff, that's the stuff to eat while fighting sea rats gruff. That pirate captain, he got shot by a barrel load of peas. What blackened his eyes and stung his thighs and fractured all his knees. We hit the crew with onion skins, big cabbage stalks as well. With hard crust pies and horrible cries, they splashed into the swell. Woe, Skillion Duff, that's the stuff when vermin crews you must rebuff. As Wobblechop sailed away that day, we sang a jolly song. The bottle-nosed cook with laughter shook as the dinner bell went bong. I'm old and fat with a greasy hat, but this to you I say, I must have scoffed a score of bowls of Skillion Duff that day. Woe, Skillion Duff, that's the stuff when winter winds do howl and puff. High King Mokin slept, though not peacefully or well, that night. The Marl Fox's dreams were a nightmare of disjointed visions. Lontor, the sister he had slyly murdered, kept trying to drag him into the pike-infested lake, smiling wickedly at him and repeating a hollow chant. Never trust a vixen, never trust a vixen. He turned to run, but was confronted by the brothers and sisters he had deserted. Their faces pale and wan, they pointed accusingly at him, murmuring, Blood for blood, a Marl Fox lies slain, some beast must pay, blood calls for blood. He fled from them, and seeking safety, found himself leaping into his mother's palanquin. However, he was surrounded not by a silk curtain, but by the tapestry from Redwall Abbey. Stern-faced and fearless, the mouse warrior figure stepped out from the tapestry and raised his magnificent sword. Panic such as he had never known seized Moken. With the blood in his veins like ice water, he hurled himself from the palanquin. Time stood still, and the Marl Fox stumbled slowly to the ground, only to find himself confronted by others. A grim-faced young squirrel, wielding the same sword that the warrior mouse had brandished. A squirrel maid, armed with a rod tipped by a glowing green stone. A great black-and-white eagle, talons spread, beak open. Creatures he could not identify, a water vole, a shrew, hedgehogs, all gathered around him, and his mother's voice echoed mockingly in the gloom. "Hail, High King Moken, last of the Marl Fox brood!" Grabbing his cloak, he hid his face in it and screamed, but the scream died to a whimper as the cloak tightened around his throat, threatening to strangle him. "No, please, no!" Moken woke on the floor of his bedchamber with a silken sheet, which had become caught on a bedpost as he rolled about trying to escape the dark world of fearful slumber, wrapped tightly about his neck. Throwing open the chamber door, he glared wildly at the two water rat sentries, standing immobile in the flickering torchlight. They gazed back dully at the new High King, panting, disheveled, with a bedsheet draped around his neck. Slamming the door, he retreated back into the bedchamber, taking a deep draught of wine from a pitcher and tossing aside the sheet. Then he stood at the window, letting the rain cool his fevered brow, staring out into the dark, wet night. What acts of murder and treachery had his own mother committed, that she too always slept uneasily? Was this what it was like to gain the power of kingship? 33. Gojo had taken the last night watch on deck. The rain slacked off to a steady drizzle before dawn, when the old squirrel warrior returned to the cabin. Checking that the stove fire was burned down to white ashes, he unshuttered both windows. McGraw stirred from his perch on a shelf. "Again, it'll be a big day today, Alden." Gojo Swifteye was still nimble and strong, despite his many seasons. He took down a short lance from the motley array of weaponry hanging from the wall. "Aye, friend, 'twill be a big day. Shorter for some than others before 'tis over. Come on, crew, stir yourselves. The island of Marl Foxes is in sight." Song stared around herself in the half-light. Her grandpa and the hedgehogs were ready and armed. Burble sat up, rubbing sleep from his eyes. "Well, whatever happens later can wait, yes. I'm hungry right now, so I am." Dippler and Dan were already at the table, helping themselves to warm fruit cordial and oat cakes that had been baked the night before. McGraw hopped up to an open window. "No use a-waitin' for yon magpies to find us, I'm thinking. This time I'll catch them nappin'. Good luck, see you later." Launching himself from the windowsill, the great eagle sailed off into the rising dawn-streaked skies. Gojo addressed his remaining crew. "Friends, you all know what to do. Dan, we'll give you and Torov until mid-morning. Is the swallow ready?" Dan strapped the sword across his back, nodding to Torov and the other four hedgehogs he would be traveling with. "She's ready, sir. Well stocked with weapons, too." Gojo shook the young squirrel's paw heartily. "Luck go with you, Danflor Raguba." Song, Dippler, and Burble pushed the boat out from the raft's port side. Sitting behind the hedgehogs, Dan waved his paddle. "See you later, mates, I hope." The three friends waved to him silently, then stood by their poling positions at the side rails. Gojo called out from the stern, where he sat plying the tiller. "No time to waste, crew. Let's get there quick as we can." All eyes were fixed on the mysterious island, looming up, dark and forbidding, with Castle Marl dominating its rocky landing plateau. Owing to the previous day's events, when the rule of the island had changed so swiftly, the castle courtyards, front and back, lay silent. Moken had let the guards celebrate, and they were not yet up and about. In the slave pens, the captives were beginning to stir. An old mouse stood with his face pressed to the bars. Behind him, a grizzled otter hauled himself stiffly up from the damp straw that served them as bedding. "What's happening out there, matey?" The mouse was joined by a sturdy hedgehog maid. "Well, it ain't breakfast, that's for sure. Where's the guards today? Still sleeping, I suppose." "They'll appear all in good time. After all, we ain't going nowheres, are we?" called a squirrel slave from the back of the pen. The mouse chuckled humorlessly at his dry remark. "Right enough there, friend. We may as well make the best of our extra rest. Better than toiling in the fields, drenched by that rain we had yesterday. I'm still damp all over. They sat in silence for a while, watching the clear dawn rise, thankful that the rain had ceased. The otter suddenly cocked his head on one side, listening. What was that noise?
I heard a funny sound.
Probably my stomach telling me mouth it's time to eat. Catching the hedgehog's paw, the otter silenced her.
No, it wasn't that, mate. Listen.
Something metallic clinked against the back wall top, then clinked again as it fell back. There was a whirring noise, followed by a brief silence. A thick knotted rope flew down past the bars, with a three-pronged grappling hook tied to its end that hit the courtyard stones with a ringing clank. Dumbfounded for a moment, they stood looking at it. Then the hog maid moved swiftly. Grabbing a piece of wet sacking, she lay flat and flopped it through the bars. It caught on the grapples, and she pulled it back in until the hook was in her reach. Her paws shook with excitement as she held onto the rope and the grappling hook. The old mouse gazed at it in disbelief as the other slaves crowded round.
Why'd any beast want to throw that to us?
Wedging the hook firmly between the bars, the otter gave the rope three sharp tugs. He, too, was shaking all over.
One thing's sure. It ain't marl foxes, water rats, or magpies.
Whoever 'tis, they must be friends. Let's help 'em. Dan came shinning over the back wall. At the top he gave a swift look around, then signaled down to the hedgehogs below. A moment later he had dropped down into the courtyard, and was staring into the pen at the emaciated slaves pressing forward to the bars. Unshouldering his sword, he flashed them a quick smile.
Good morrow to you, mates. I'm Dan Raguba. Any beast fancy being liberated today?
Raising the sword high, he swung it down energetically, shearing the lock from the slave pen door with one mighty swipe. Slaves stood gawping in amazement. Dan swung the door open as they found their tongues.
Did you see that? He chopped off the lock, and his blade ain't even nicked. By thunder, that's some kind of sword, mates.
Dan Raguba. What sort of name is that?
I know. I've heard it afore.
That un's a mighty warrior. I'm with him.
Woe to the beast who stands in the way of a Raguba.
A shudder of pride ran through Dan. He strode into the cage and was surrounded by creatures trying to shake his paw, all of them with tears in their eyes at the unexpected arrival of help. Torab followed with her hedgehogs, bundles of arms strapped to their backs. They passed out spears, slings, blades, and javelins to the eager captives. An otter spoke for his fellow slaves as he loaded stone into sling.
Just say the word, Dan. We're with you all the way, mate.
Dan closed the door, hanging the broken lock back in place.
Sit tight here, friends. You'll get the word soon enough.
Overhead, a harsh screeching of bird call cut the morning air, followed by a mighty flutter of wings and the hunting call of an eagle. Feathers fell like a miniature snowstorm into the courtyard. Dan had no need to look. He knew the mighty McGraw was wreaking vengeance upon his enemies. Magpies shrieked harshly with terror. More feathers swirled to the courtyard stones and floated into the pen. Slaves ran to the bars, clutching at them as they struggled to catch a glimpse of retribution being visited on the hateful birds, straining and craning their necks upward, pushing against the bars.
An eagle! 'Tis a great eagle up there, hunting magpies!
There was a thud on the pen roof, and the huddled carcass of Athrock rolled off onto the stones below.
The eagle's slain! Athrock, look, look!
From above, the osprey's war cry could be heard as he pursued magpies out across the lake.
Remember me, my bonny bairns. I'm no half asleep and helpless now. I'm the mighty McGraw. Death on wings to ye. Kariga!
Guards came tumbling out of the barracks, still sleepy-eyed, buckling on armor and stumbling over weapons. Dan kicked open the slave pen door and hurtled out with an army of slaves brandishing weapons behind him.
Charge!
The raft thudded in against the rocky plateau. Song and her grandpa leapt ashore as mooring ropes snaked out behind them. Securing the raft, Gojo was forced to duck as a small cloud of magpies sped low overhead, pursued by the mighty McGraw. They fled out across the lake with the eagle hard on their tails like some avenging beast. Gojo gripped Song's paw as the sound of Dan and his slave army, giving their battle cry, rang out from the castle above.
Stay by me, pretty one. The family'd never forgive me if anything happened to you.
On the double, crew!
They charged up the slope toward Castle Marl, slamming the gatehouse door shut as they passed, and locking the half-awake guards inside. As they burst into the front courtyard, Song caught a glimpse of Mokun at an upper chamber window. At once she remembered the original purpose of their quest.
"Dip, Burb, there's the Marl Fox. Come on, that's where the tapestry must be."
For Mokun, it was like a continuation of his nightmare. There below in the courtyard of Castle Marl, the creatures he had fled from in dreams were staring boldly up at him.
Fear gripped the Marl Fox, and he looked about wildly, seeking an avenue of escape. The shrew logboat he had arrived in still lay moored to one side of the rock plateau that served as a jetty. That was it. Dashing from his room, he motioned at the two guards posted outside.
"Follow me. Slay any beast who tries to stop your king."
They ran obediently with him, along the corridor sloping upward to Wilka's former room, which now belonged to Tulum, commander of the army. Mokun burst in on the slumbering rat.
"Rouse yourself, fool. Foe beasts are at large in the castle."
Tulum rushed to get his new armor on, over a voluminous nightgown, then hefted his heavy spear.
Sire, your word is my command, your majesty. Muster the soldiers, every one. Sweep these invaders from my island. Slay them, or take them prisoner. I will see you when this incident is finished. Fail me, and you will go to serve the teeth of the deeps. Go now. You two go with him.
When they had gone, Mokun dropped his heavily embroidered cloak of kingship and slunk swiftly down to the main chamber. There he donned his old cloak of dull brown and green weave. Immediately a transformation came over him, and his pale eyes glowed. Now he was a proper Marl Fox once more, and every beast knew that Marl Foxes were magic and visible. Blending in with the stones of the wall, Mokun slipped off down the back corridors. Burble panted along with Dippler in Song's wake, staring around in puzzlement.
"Dip, will you look at this place? There's neither step nor stair anywheres. 'Tis all slopes, Yusius."
Song rounded on the pair and pulled them into a darkened alcove, beckoning them to silence as the sound of clanking spears against breastplates reached her ears.
"Some beast dashing down to the courtyard. Stand by."
Tulum and the two water rat sentries came into view, hurrying clumsily down the slope. Song whispered,
"One each. Wait until they pass."
No sooner were the three vermin past the alcove than Song and her two friends hit them from behind. Amid a resounding jumble of weaponry and armor, the three rats crashed headlong into the wall stones and slid down senseless. Song could not resist a slight giggle.
"Sounded like some beast tripping into a broom closet at Redwall Abbey. Come on, the Marl Fox's room must be somewhere up this passage. Go careful now. They'll have heard the noise."
There were other chambers either side of the torchlit passage, but Song knew right away that the one with ornate double doors would be the chamber where the Marl Fox had been sighted. Dippler and Burble had armed themselves with the sentry's spears. Brandishing her leafwood stick, Song gave them a quick nod. They charged the doors, yelling their battle cries.
"Logga, logga, logga, log! Wailahoo! Red Wall!"
The doors were not locked. In fact, they were not even closed properly, and they slammed inward under the force of the charge. Song, Dippler, and Burble exploded into the chamber, heads over tails in a mad jumble. The squirrel maid was first upright, ready to do battle, but feeling rather foolish at the instant realization that she was facing an empty room. Dippler and Burble sat up, gazing around the chamber in awe. Silken hangings, burnished metal mirrors, incense burners, and satin cushions were everywhere. The water bowl scurried over to the large carved oaken chair that was serving as the High King's temporary throne and plumped down on it.
"Yes, this is a grand old chair, so 'tis. I always promised myself one of these. I think I'll plunder it."
Song and Dippler were not listening. They were staring at the great red wall tapestry, hanging in all its glory. Martin the warrior's likeness seemed to smile down on them both. Dippler clasped his friend's paw.
"Wait till Dan sees this, Missy. You've completed your quest."
Pride flooded through Song. It had been a long and perilous journey, but they had completed it successfully. Snapping out of her reverie, she rousted Burble from his plundered throne.
"Come on, Cushy Tail, up with you. We need this chair."
She and Dippler dragged it over to the wall where the tapestry hung. Climbing onto the seat, they began taking down the heavy object, with Burble hopping about protesting.
"Ah, go easy now. Don't scratch the woodwork. Watch how you treat me lovely old chair. Yes, be careful."
Rolling the tapestry up, they stood it behind one of the doors. Dippler tore down a silk wall hanging and draped it over the prize, effectively hiding it from view.
"There it should be safe enough here for the moment.
What's up, Sonk? What are you looking round like that for? Where did the Marl Fox go? There's another thing, too. Have you noticed that it's gone quiet out there?
Burble looked up from the chair he was covering with drapes.
Yes, yes, you're right there, mate. There should be a grand old battle raging round this castle by now, but there's not a single peep from outside. Well, now, there's me plunder all wrapped up nice and tidy. Let's go and take a look.
As soon as Dan and his party had charged, the guards fled back into their barracks and locked themselves in. Torod posted two hedgehogs and several freed slaves in front of the barracks, calling in a loud voice so the water rats could hear,
"Stay thou by here. Slay any who come out."
She turned with a shrug to the bemused Dan. "Mayhap yon vermin do not move without command from some captain or Marl Fox. They bear the look of beasts who be not overburdened with much intelligence." Dan took a parting glance at the dull-faced soldiers penned within their own barracks.
I think you're right, Torob. Let's go and see how Gorjo and the others are faring at the front entrance.
Ulleg and Wilka were in the main barracks, demoted to the rank and file. When they saw Gorjo and his small force enter the courtyard, both vermin grasped immediately their chance of being restored to favor. After a hasty conference together, they took up weapons. Ulleg faced the horde of soldiers, who were lounging about awaiting orders from Tulum, who had not yet appeared.
"Arm yourselves! There are enemies within our gates! Hurry!"
The rats looked at him, but made no move. Wilka shook her spear at them, haranguing the indifferent vermin.
"You heard him, idiots! Pick up your weapons!"
One, bolder than the rest, sat down on his bed.
"You ain't officers no more. You're only the same as us. We ain't taking no orders off'n yer."
Wilka's brain was racing as she challenged the speaker.
"Us, common soldiers? Don't be stupid. Who told you that?"
Slightly unsure of himself, the water rat pointed out one of his comrades.
He did.
Ulleg did not hesitate. He slew the vermin who had been singled out with a sharp spear thrust. Turning on the rest, he shook his head pityingly.
"Him? What did he know about it? Barrack room gossip. You all know me and Wilka here. King Mokan asked us to pose as common soldiers for a while, just to sniff out any traitors or rebels who was still loyal to the impostor Lantur. We're still in command here, so pick up your weapons and follow us, or it'll go hard on you."
Gorjo and his party were about to enter the castle when the main barrack doors burst open and vermin began charging toward them. The old squirrel warrior turned to face the foe, backed by his 10 big hogs, and rushed the enemy with a blood-curdling shout.
"Gorjo!"
Their quills bristling with the madness of combat, the hedgehogs threw themselves headlong into the water rat flanks, flailing out with long heavy clubs, smashing any spears that came close, hacking and thrusting with short broad cutlasses.
"Roll in circle! Form a roll in circle!"
yelled Gorjo above the melee. The water rats did not fight with the same ferocity as their opponents, but they outnumbered them more than 10-1. Two of the hedgehogs were down before Gorjo succeeded in joining his small force into the rolling circle. Shoulder to shoulder, cheek by jowl, they fought, facing the vermin horde, turning like a wheel, plowing hither and thither into the foe beast ranks. A spear blade slashed down across Gorjo's paw, as the hedgehog on his right side was overwhelmed by the crushing force of vermin. The old squirrel sighed as he slid in the blood flowing from his paw. They had underestimated the number of enemies. In a short time his column would go under.
"Raguba! Strike for freedom!"
Dan and his slave army came charging to the rescue. They hit the vermin's flank like a tidal wave, changing the face of the battle completely. Ulleg and Wilka had fallen to the rear, careful not to be in the front line. Now, when the huge mob of reinforcements arrived, they saw defeat looming.
"That's torn it. Let's get out of here,"
Wilka muttered to her companion. A huge paw smacked down on Ulleg's shoulder, and he was knocked flat by a burly hedgehog maid. She smiled grimly at him as she raised a loaded sling and spoke the last words Ulleg was ever to hear in his life.
"Well, well, even it ain't Ulleg the slave captain."
A crowd of slaves cornered Wilka. She had nowhere to run.
"Look, mates, 'tis Madam Iron Mighty, Lantur's old pet."
"Aye, she had me beaten just for looking at her.
Remember she had our rations cut when 'twas too cold for us to work?
I remember that was a hard winter. I vowed if ever I got the chance I'd pay her back some day. Now the time's come."
Wilka's final shriek, as they fell upon her, was so piercing that it actually caused a lull in the fighting. Song and her two friends emerged into the courtyard just as Wilka screamed. It was a critical moment. The water rats ceased fighting and dropped their weapons, an uneasy murmur arising from them at the sight of their two leaders lying slain. Taking in the situation at a glance, the young squirrel maid tried a desperate gamble. Raising the leaf wood high above her head, she strolled boldly among the vermin, calling out, "Surrender, and you will not be harmed. The Marl Fox is gone, and your leaders are dead. Surrender, I command you. Surrender! Sit down upon the ground, all those who want to live." Whether it was the authority carried by her voice, or the fact that the slow-witted vermin were conditioned to obey orders, Song never knew. She looked about, trying to hide her astonishment. Every vermin soldier was seated firmly on the ground, watching her. Burble's outburst almost ruined the moment. "All except you four. Yes, yes, you're fine big buckos. I want you to carry me nice old chair down there and..." "Ouch!" Torov had silenced the water bowl by treading heavily on his footpaw. She glared at him ferociously. "Seal thy foolish mouth, River Mousy." Meanwhile, Mokin hurried along the damp rock passages that ran beneath Castle Marl, holding a small lantern. The tunnels wound many different ways in maze-like patterns, but the Marl Fox kept unerringly to one passage, sure of his destination. It was a rusty metal door, small and set low at the rear of an alcove. Mokin gritted his teeth as he prized with his axe blade, forcing the door to squeak in protest as it was wrenched open. He held the lantern ring in his teeth as he scraped through the doorway and began the long upward climb along a tunnel carved into the solid rock. At the top he slid aside a flat slab and emerged into broad daylight. Tossing the lantern into the tunnel, he drew his cloak tight and took off along the boundary where the woodland grew down to meet the rocks. A sudden sound caused him to pause, then move silently back into the shade of a rowan and become almost one with it, using the Marl Fox art of camouflage. Durlo passed by him, glancing fearfully back at the high side wall of Castle Marl. Mokin materialized behind the water rat and dealt him a sharp blow with his axe handle. Durlo sprawled on the ground, one paw to his injured shoulder, the other held to his face, as he cringed to avoid his master.
"I wasn't running away, Majesty. I was... don't kill me."
Mokin kicked him contemptuously.
"Get up, you whining oaf. Follow me and do as I say."
Shortly afterward, they lay among the loose rocks close to the plateau. Mokin's axe blade pressed between Durlo's shoulder blades as he whispered orders.
"Get down there fast and paddle that logboat over here. I'll be waiting for you. Hurry."
Gojo allowed Song to bandage his paw as they strode behind the vermin to the lakefront.
"Grandpa, will you keep still, please? This wound has to be bound, and I can't do it while you walk."
The old squirrel warrior winked at her fondly.
"My little Song, the sweet voice of reason. Time for all that when we've finished this job."
At the water's edge, the defeated rats were made to pile up their armor and weapons, helmets, breastplates, and shields in one heap, spears, slings, bows, arrows, and swords in a separate array. Dan took command of the disposal.
"You creatures have no need of armor. On an island such as this, there'll be no need to attack or defend from this day forward. So step up smart now, and let's see you sling all this gear into the lake."
Gojo admired his neatly bandaged paw as Song skimmed a shield out over the water. It skipped four times, then sank with the noon sun glinting off it. The old squirrel warrior watched as it disappeared from view, butted from side to side by the hooked snouts of curious pike.
"Well, missy, there goes the garments of war. That was a good idea of yours. 'Tis nice to have a clever granddaughter."
Song was as tall as her grandpa, so it was not difficult to throw an affectionate paw about his shoulders.
"Aye, and it isn't so bad having a good old grandpa."
The weapons were next to go. Dan noticed that some of the vermin were actually enjoying it, laughing as they aimed their spears far out into the lake.
"Ho, ho, mate, mine went further than yours." "Well, what's this for a good throw?"
"Ha! Last time I'll ever polish my spear for guard duty. Remember how Ulig used to have us beaten for parading with a dust speck on our spear blades?"
"Aye, curse his memory. This was his sword. I hope it rust to nothing in the waters."
The polished blade flashed in the sunlight, splashed into the lake, and was lost to sight forever.
Mokin was concealed by high shelving rock at the side of the plateau as he climbed down to the waiting logboat, with the laughter and cheers of his defeated army ringing in his ears. Durlow crouched nervously at the water's edge, keeping a wary eye on the pike, watching him hungrily from just below the waterline. He held the stern of the logboat steady for the Marl Fox. Mokin pushed past the water rat and jumped into the waiting craft, which wobbled perilously for a moment and then settled. Seating himself, Mokin readied his paddle, nodding to Durlow. "Get in."
"I ain't going with you, sire."
Mokin stared at his subordinate in disbelief.
"What did you say?"
A look of stubborn resolution was in the water rat's eyes.
"I said I ain't going with you, Marl Fox."
A quiver of rage shook Mokin. "When this is over, I'll be back," he snarled. "Mark my words, rat, you'll be screaming for death before I'm finished with you." Durlow gave the logboat a hefty shove, shooting it out onto the lake, smiling happily at the irate Marl Fox.
"Your killing days are over. Bad luck go with your majesty."
The last of the water rat's weapons had been cast into the lake when Mokin hove into view, paddling furiously. Dippler was first to sight him and hopped about wildly.
"Look, the Marl Fox! There he goes!"
Mokin paddled like a wild beast to get out of weapon range. Dan ground his teeth in frustration.
"He's getting away! Gojo, what'll we do?"
The old squirrel shook his head.
"We can't do anything, Dan. The Marl Fox is out of range. No beast could throw a spear that far."
Suddenly every beast leapt to one side. A whirring noise filled the air.
"Hurrung! Hurrung! Take this with you, vermin!"
A former slave, the burly young hedgehog maid, raced forward to the rocky plateau brink. She was swinging an iron slave chain in both paws. Faster and faster she whirled it, until it became a blur. Song pulled her grandpa down flat, narrowly avoiding the broken manacles at the chain's end, as the links thrummed louder and louder.
"Hurrum! Hurrum! Hurrum!"
The hogmaid released the chain, and it whizzed out over the lake, a whirlwind of metal. She was carried forward by the mighty throw, slipping off the plateau into the water. Like lightning, Torab and two of her brothers yanked her back, a pike clinging to her footpaw. Mokin was just turning his head to look back as the chain struck him, wrapping around his neck in the blink of an eye, and whipping him straight into the water. The teeth of the deeps, the ravening pike shoals that preyed upon any living thing that was cast into their domain, closed in. Long silver bodies, bristling dorsal fins, and ferocious ripping teeth, threshing the water to foam. So ended the reign of High King Mokin, last of the Marl Foxes. A mighty cheer rose from the freed slaves. The water rat stared blankly for a moment, then joined in wholeheartedly. The young hedgehog maid sat inspecting her footpaw, and Song sat down beside her, eyes shining with admiration.
"That was a mighty throw, miss. You must possess great strength. What do they call you?"
"My name is Nettlebud."
Song shook her paw warmly.
"I know your father well. He'll be overjoyed to see you."
Verbal scurried about, reassuring slaves and water rats, as McGraw came swooping down to land on the plateau.
"Don't fuss now. My friend won't harm you. He's on our side, yes, yes, and we're thankful for that."
Folding his massive wings, the osprey nodded at Song.
"Weel, lassie, I take it the battle's o'er. You'll no be seeing magpies round here nae mair."
No beast doubted the fierce fish eagle's word. Dippler eyed his logboat, floating empty out on the lake.
"I could take a dozen or so in the logboat when we gets it back to land. Any beast want to come with me? I'm going home."
Home.
The beautiful word meant everything to the creatures gathered by the lake's edge. Some of the freed slaves broke into sobs and wept at the thought of it. Gojo was one of those who could not hold back a tear. Dan thought of Redwall and his father, and his own eyes filled.
"Look at him blubberin', Song,"
Dippler whispered.
"Bet you can't start every beast weepin' by singin' something nice and sad."
Song tweaked the Gwasom Shrew's ear.
"You heartless little horror, bet I can. Just give me a moment to dry my eyes."
There on the rocks of the sunlit island, the young squirrel maid's voice rang out into the late summer afternoon.
"Please gaze round our garden, remember me there, and always be faithful and true. Then look to the sunset and know that somewhere 'tis I who'll be thinking of you. Home." Home, I will come home, back to the ones I love best. Home, home, no more to roam, my weary heart will find rest. So leave the door open and keep the fire bright, as I recall it was always. It may be evening or dawn's welcome light, I'll wander back one of these days. Home, home, I will come home, ere the long seasons have passed. Home, home, no more to roam, peace we will find there at last.
In the hush that followed, Song noticed Dippler weeping. 34. Rimro sat at the abbey pond's edge with Krega, Sister Slowey, Elayo, Deesum, and Gerbold Sellermole. Between them they were candying nuts and fruit, shelling hazels, almonds, and chestnuts, slicing apples and pears, removing stones from plums, damsons, and greengages, and selecting berries. These they layered in pottery jars, pouring in honey, then sealing the tops with bark circles and beeswax. Sister Slowey watched a crew of moles carrying ladders out of the abbey. They finished fixing all the window panes, Craigamarm. The blind Badgermarm nodded fondly.
At last Redwall is restored to its former glory, and our beautiful tapestry will soon be back where it belongs.
I can stand in the center of Great Hall and feel it. I know I can.
Gerbil placed another full jar to one side. Her, that be'd a long job, all right. This day's the last day of season, by my reckoning. Rimrose looked up from her work.
The last day of summer? Surely not. You said that Song and her friends would be back by then, Krega.
The blind badger pulled the stalk from an apple and began slicing it expertly.
That's what my dream told me, Rimrose. Maybe summer has a few more days to run yet. Are you sure your calculations are right, Gerbil?
The mole wife nodded solemnly.
There bain't no mistakes in my calculations, marm.
Elayo reassured Gerbil hastily.
Oh, we ain't questioning your reckoning, marm. Matter of fact, summer does seem to have gone on quite long this season. Oh, by the way, has any beast seen Mr. Florian and the Dibbons today?
They was aunting us yesterday, pinching nuts and dabbing their paws in our honey, getting up to all sorts of roguery they were.
Wonder where they've gotten to.
Deesum nodded in the direction of Mossflower Wood.
Berry picking. I heard Mr. Jangler and Mr. Rossville say at breakfast that they'd go along with Florian to keep an eye on the Dibbons.
Huh. Rather them than us, I say. Imagine having charge of that lot in the woodlands. I'll wager they come back filthy, with their smocks all snagged and ripped.
Rimrose poured honey into a jar, chuckling.
Mr. Florian will be glad to get Dwapple and his gang back here, I should imagine. Is that them now coming in the main gate? Deary me, just look at the state they're in.
A band of Dibbons charged across the lawn, stained red and purple with berry juice. Jangler and Russell followed, towing a cartload of baskets. Florian followed up, breathlessly trying to take a head count of the abbey babes.
5, 6, 7... Be still, you blighters, what? Come back here, back, I say. Young sirs and missies, line up correctly. Oh, confound the blighters, I've gone and lost count again. 3, 4, 5... Stop dodging about there, Dwapple. I've gone and counted you twice again. You should be 5.
Or was it 4?
No, 3, that's right. Now, 3, 4, 5...
Sister Slowey took a correct count as the Dibbons ran toward her.
Mr. Florian, sir, I've got a count. There's 22 in all. Is that how many you went out with?
Dwapple swiped a strawberry and dipped it in honey.
Course not. 22's Nora, right? Us went out with 23. This morning, Mr. Rusbull counted them twice.
Rusbull and Jangler took a swift count, which tallied with Sister Slowey's. They dropped the cart handles.
One's missing, Jang. We'll have to go back to the woodlands.
No, you stay here, Russ. I'll go.
Rimrose hurried past them both.
You take a rest. I'll go. There's some cold mint tea setting in the pond shallows. Help yourselves. You deserve it.
Florian Dugglewolf Wolfachop was first to the tea jug.
Ah, jolly good. Cold tea after a flippin' day chasing those ruffians round bush and shrub. Nothing like it.
Rimrose found the Dibbon, a baby dormouse named Guff, with enormous ears. He had toddled right on past the main gates, and was close to the end of the wall, going south. Rimrose caught up with him, though he started to run, and she had to chase him. She swept the tiny fellow up into her paws.
"Where do you think you're off to, my little button?
Guff pointed a berry-stained paw south down the path. "Gonna zing down der," the good squirrel wife translated Guff's baby talk.
"Going to sing down there? Why do you want to do that?"
The dormouse babe looked at her as if the answer was obvious.
"'Cause dat's where all a singin' bees."
Rimrose did not doubt the Dibbon's word. His large, sensitive ears could pick up sounds far better than hers. She stood there holding the little creature, listening for quite a while, until her ears, too, picked up the noise. It came from many voices raised heartily as they came through the woods, roaring out an old ballad called Seven Seasons Gone. Rimrose felt her paws trembling as she lowered Guff back to the path. Excitement and many differing emotions crowded in on her, so that she could hardly put her words together correctly.
"Tell them, Abby, tell them, Janglur. Tell my daughter coming home. Quick, Abby."
Guff nodded. He understood perfectly. Dibbon spoke like that all the time. It was no problem. He trundled off toward Redwall while Rimrose dashed the other way, her skirts and aprons flapping as she yelled herself hoarse.
"Song! It's Song! My daughter's coming home!"
Soon the dust cloud was seen rising above the trees, tramping paws keeping up with the old marching ballad. Strung across four pikestaffs, borne by Song, Dan, Dippler, and Gojo, the great red wall tapestry provided a fitting banner as they bellowed the words. "Seven seasons gone, oh seven seasons gone, but now I'm coming home, my dear old mate. Over valley, hill, and field, and me footpaws didn't yield. Get some victuals on the table, I can't wait. Go to the left, right, left. Go to the left, right, left. Seven seasons gone, oh, seven seasons gone. Have the little ones all growed up big and strong? Is me father in the chair? Do his snores ring through the air? Now I'm going to wake him up with this old song. Go to the left, right, left. Go to the left, right, left. Seven seasons gone, oh, seven seasons gone. I've been fighting, roaring, marching all the time. But I'm coming home to you to give you a hug or two, the moment that I've supped a jug of wine. Go to the left, right, left, go to the left, right, left. Bong, boom, bong, boom, bong, boom. The bells of Redwall Abbey tolled out like melodious rolling thunder. Chores, rest, recreation, and duty were forgotten. Redwallers poured out onto the path outside the gates to see the brave sight. Aprons waved and cook's caps were flung into the air. Craiga seized Friar Bunny and sat him upon her mighty shoulders, yelling,
"What do you see, friend? Tell me what you can see."
The old recorder's voice squeaked with eagerness.
"I see Song, Dan, and the young Wassum. What's his name? Dippler. There's an old squirrel marching alongside them. Looks like a seasoned warrior to me. I see a rank of hedgehogs, biggest I ever set eyes on. Must be close to a score of them. Right behind them, there's squirrels, mice, moles, even some otters. They're smiling, laughing, singing, pounding the dust up high as they come. Oh, Craiga, Marm, did you ever see such a sight?"
Craiga chuckled at the thought of a blind badger seeing any sight, but she understood her friend's jubilation.
"No, I never saw such a sight, Friar. What else do you see?" "I see Martin the warrior. They've done it. They've brought the great tapestry home to Redwall."
Rusfold grabbed his son's paws with a fierceness Dan could feel, dust settling on their faces as they stared intently at each other.
"Dan, that night, I'm sorry."
Dan seemed to have grown taller and broader.
"Forget it, Raguba."
Rusfold held his son at paw's length.
"No, Dan, you're the Raguba now. Let me look at the son who's made me proud to see a warrior standing before me."
Jangler and Rimrose hugged Song so hard she could scarcely breathe.
"Oh, Song, Song, thank the seasons you're back safe."
"Well, Missy, I'll bet you've sung some songs and been through a few adventures since you left your old dad and mum.
Ha-ha, you're even prettier than when you went away."
Song found herself looking over Jangler's shoulder at her grandpa and Elio, staring at one another like two creatures in a dream.
"Gojo Swifteye, is it really you?"
"Aye, 'tis me, Elio, me dear. Older and grayer, though maybe none the wiser. Bet I'm a sight to make sore eyes sorer, eh?"
"Oh, no, Gojo. You look handsome, all silver-furred and well."
"Aye, but not half so pretty as you, Elio. You've not changed a single hair.
Wait, is that our son, Janglor?" You could wager on it, Gorjo. That apple never fell far from the tree. He's the breath out of your mouth. Go to him.
Thank you, I will.
Oh, Torab, bring your crew over here. Elio, I want you to meet your other sons and daughters.
The old squirrel wife looked up at the big hedgehog surrounding her and shook her head in amazement.
My sons and daughters? Great seasons! You there, you look too big to be any beast's son.
The giant hedgehog bowed, his face wreathed in smiles.
Ho, ho, Mom. I ain't your son. I'm just a visitor. My name's Solitree, and this is my daughter Nettlebud, and our friend Goodwife Brim. She's a fine cook, I can assure you, Mom.
Dippler found himself chatting to many Gwasom friends.
Poor old Pargle. That's another Logalog we lost, mates. Who's chieftain of the tribe now? You, Man? Or Splicker, maybe? I'm sure you've chosen another Logalog since I've been gone.
Man shook his head ruefully.
No, mate. Bargle was only acting Logalog. We can't make a new chief until we catch up with that murdering Fenno.
Dippler looked puzzled.
Fenno?
Surely you weren't thinking of making that blackguard into a Logalog.
Oh, no. But Gwasom law states clear that a new chieftain can't be appointed until the old one is avenged.
Splicker explained.
The guerrilla union rule is that when a Logalog dies by the paw of a Gwasom shrew...
Dippler interrupted him, as shrews invariably do when debating.
Listen, matey, you've no need to go hunting Fenno. I caught up with that murdering scum and slew him with my own sword, even though it was snapped in half. He's deader than last season's grass, and good riddance to the villain.
Every beast turned as the shrews threw up their paws and pointed their snouts toward Dippler, setting up a shout.
Log-a-log-a-log-a-log-a-log-a-log!
The young Gwasom shrew stood totally embarrassed.
Ahoy, mates! Steady on there! What's all the shouting about?
A venerable old shrew named Marglow came forward, carrying something wound in bark cloth.
You're only a young'un. Stands to reason you're not expected to know all of the Gwasom law, so I'll quote some to you. The paw of the shrew that slays the beast, who made our chieftain fall, will wield the sword of Gwasom and be Logalog over all.
Marglow unwrapped the bark cloth from a short rapier. Dippler recognized his dead leader's blade straight away. The oldster presented it to him ceremoniously.
From this day forth, your name is forgotten in our tribe. Take the chieftain's blade. Hail Logalog of all Gwasom!
Every beast on the path in front of Redwall set up an ear-splitting cheer. Skipper waved them to silence.
Would you like to say a word to your tribe, Logalog, me old mate? Come on, don't be shy.
The new Logalog thrust the rapier into his belt.
Ahem. Now let me see. Yes. Gwasom. I'm only young, but I'll try to be as good a Logalog as our olden was.
Fortune smiled on his memory.
But I've been thinking. No more logboats for us. We're going to build new vessels, light and swift and easy to carry over land. Soon now I'll take you to see my friend Chief Burble, boss of the River Ed Water Bulls. He's the bucko who'll show us how to bank boats, like the Swallow. Neatest little craft ever to sail a stream. Oh, and there's another thing. I won't stand to see any young'uns in our tribe pushed around or bullied or made fun of. That's all for now. But I'll think of more to say to you later.
Dan strode over to congratulate his friend.
Well said, Logalog. I think you'll be a great chieftain.
Krega's searching paw reached Dan.
What about you, Sir Raguba? Have you got any plans?
Who, me? No, not really, Marm. Oh, I'm sorry, here's your sword back. Sorry I borrowed it without permission.
Jangler's lazy eyes flickered as he murmured to Gorjo and Russell. Just watch young Dan's face when Krega tells him the news. The blind badger's paw closed tightly over Dan's, holding the sword there. Every beast heard what she had to say.
The sword of Martin is yours now, for as long as you shall defend this abbey with it. Danflor Raguba, I name you champion of Redwall.
Before the cheering could start anew, Skipper's paw shot aloft.
Belay the roarin', mates. There's more to come yet. Now, is there a song breeze, Swift Eye, among us today? Well, if there is, you better get yourself over here smartish.
Willing paws ushered Song forward, until she was standing alongside Dan in front of Craig Badgermum.
Looking slightly bemused, the squirrel maid whispered to her friend,
"Hope they're not going to ask me to sing. My mouth's full of dust from that long track."
Alayo twicked her granddaughter's ear.
"Manners, stop whispering and listen to what the badger mom has to say to you, missy."
A hush had fallen on the crowd. Curious onlookers at the back stood on tip-paw to see and hear what Krega was about to say. She did not keep them waiting.
"Song, you are to be the Abbess of Redwall."
The crowd went wild with delight. It took Skipper Solitree, Torab, and several stout hedgehogs to restore order and a degree of quiet. The pretty squirrel maid sat down upon the dusty path, completely dumbfounded, as Krega continued.
"Redwall Abbey needs someone like you, miss, young, bright, and courageous. Dan is our champion, and he will have his father, Janglor, and Skipper to advise him. You, as Abbess, can always look to your grandma, your mother, or to me for help. We will happily assist you in your decisions."
Song stood up slowly, her eyes searching Krega's face.
"But why me? There are many Redwallers who have lived here far longer than I have. Sister Slowey, Friar Butty, Troglo Spearback. It is an honor far beyond my wildest dreams, Marm. Tell me, why do you choose me as Abbess?"
The blind badger gave her reasons readily.
"While you were gone, I was visited in my dreams by Martin the Warrior. This is what he told me. 4 chieftains from the isle return, but 1 with his own tribe will stay. 3 will return back to this place on summertime's last day. The river beast to rule his kind, where once his errors were maligned. But this to you I say, look to the young 2 went from here, a-questing for my tapestry. The Raguba and Swift Eyes maid, champion and abbess, they shall be."
Florian Dugglewolf Wolfachop bent a leg, twirled his fluffy hat, and produced the most elaborate bow any beast had yet witnessed.
"Truth will out, my dear companions, ah yes. Who among us would doubt the words of Martin the Warrior? Splendid chap, absolutely first-rate, what?
Ahem. Would you kindly bestow upon these rustic creatures a few pearls of newfound wisdom from your rose-petal lips, O Abbess Song Thingamy?"
A puzzled look crossed Song's face, and Friar Butty muttered,
"He wants you to say a few words, missy. Sorry, Abbess."
Song was lifted onto the Noonvale troop's cart. She looked down at the expectant faces gazing up at her, and took a deep breath.
"Would you like a feast?"
A roaring cheer arose.
"Yes, yes, a feast!"
Holding up her paws for silence, the young squirrel maid smiled sweetly.
"Well, you'll just have to wait. 'Tis autumn tomorrow, and the harvesting must begin. As Abbess of Redwall, I'll have no idle paws or gluttonous faces about me while there's work to be done around my abbey. Dan Raguba, I give you as champion permission to liven up any slackers, tug of the ear, swift kick in the tail, that sort of thing. And you visitors, we'll see if we can't find you some useful chores, washing pots, scrubbing floors, and what not. Oh, yes, you'd better watch out when you hear the swish of this abbess's robe."
Song stared solemnly at the crestfallen faces staring up at her, and then she gave a hearty giggle.
"Hee hee hee, stop looking at me like frogs at a funeral. What's the matter? Can't you take a joke? Listen, here are my first 4 official words to you as Abbess of Redwall. On with the feast!"
Cheering and laughing, they pushed the cart across the lawn to the abbey. Florian, bringing up the rear, chatted away to Rimrose.
"Phew, Marm. Greatly relieved, that's what yours truly is. I thought we'd voted in a right young terror to run the jolly old place, what? A proper new brush sweeps clean, stickler. Good job your pretty daughter was only joking, what? Nothing like a sense of humor, I always say. Chap should always be able to take a joke or a bit of ribbon.
Ouch!"
A pebble from the fiendish mouse babe's sling clipped Florian's tail bob. The hare dashed off after Dwapple, shouting threats.
"Assassin, rapscallion, fig doodle, pollywoggin, savage infant? Yes, you, sir. I'll kick your little tail 10 times round Great Hall if I catch you. I'll chuck you in with the flippin' apples and trample you to cider. I'll... No. Put that sling down. There's a good little chap.
Help!"
Florian flew in behind the merry cavalcade and slammed the abbey door shut. Epilogue. Extract from the records of Redwall Abbey, written by an apprentice recorder under the direction of Friar Butty. What a feast we had that day, and the 3 days following it. My word! I thought Mr. Florian could clean a platter, until I watched those big rough hedgehogs tucking in. 'Twas a good thing there was more than enough, for Redwall lived up to its name for providing lavish hospitality to every beast within its gates. Abish Song's first feast was a rousing success. I declare there never was such an array of food. 10 kinds of cheeses, 12 different breads, all crisp and fresh. Cakes, puddings, flans, trifles, tarts, and crumbles in abundance. Oh, those scones! Goody Brem baked batches of them, assisted by the giant Solitree and his long-lost daughter, Nettlebud. Solitree is the jolliest of creatures now that he has his daughter back. He brought with him a sack of almonds and a basket of dried grapes as a gift to our abbey. There was a last summer salad at the feast that had to be balanced between 2 tables because of its size. October ale and strawberry fizz were very popular, but then so was every other drink. Have you ever tasted Skilly and Duff? The Gwasa made pans of the stuff. It is very delicious and difficult to stop eating. However, the serious trencher beasts, Skipper, Florian, Troglo, and some others, went on to sample the Mole's famous deeper-never turnip and tater and beetroot pie, and the Otter's formidably spicy hot-root soup. Excellent entertainment was provided by the Noonvale troop, though our poor abbess was called upon to render ballad after ballad. I thought they would never let her sit down to eat. Martin the Warrior's tapestry was hung in its former position amid all the jollity. That feast! Redwallers will tell of it in song and story for generations to come. It was a strange and exciting adventure our travelers had to relate. We listened eagerly to the tale of how they quested to bring back our stolen tapestry. Dibben sat wide-eyed as Gawjo told them of the lost island at the center of the Great Lake and of how it was conquered. He said that now it was a place inhabited by water rats who lived there peacefully in the castle, learning to farm the land for their food. All the slaves were freed, some to return to their homes, others being part of the force that came back to Redwall. Now that the curse of the Marl Foxes was lifted from the island, it was a pleasant place to be, ruled over by a great fish eagle, whom all spoke well of. Abbess Song said that the bird's name is Mighty McGraw. She wanted him to come to the abbey with her, but he refused. We laughed at the curious speech of McGraw, and our abbess herself has written down his parting words to her. This is what he said. "Leave my island? Ach, away with you, lassie! I'm king of this place, Dickin. Atop yon castle is my perch. A bird would be oot o' his mind to leave a fine braw lake, full of bonny pikefishes, so easy to catch and good to eat. I'll bid you farewell. Go on away, back to your abbey, and eat all manner of dreadful fruit and vegetables. Maybe I'll gang aroon to see you one day." I had great difficulty understanding this, but Dwaffle and the Dibbons didn't. Often we have to bring them down from the walltops, where they stand watching for a visit from the one Dibbons call Mig-Aw-Heagle. It is mid-autumn now, and the trees shed tears of brown and gold as their leaves fall softly to the quiet earth. We gathered in the last of our orchard's russet apples yesterday. Mr. Florian and his troop decided to travel on. It was a sad parting, but after all, they are strolling players. Well, scarce half a day's journey down the path, their cart fell entirely to pieces. Since they had eaten all the provisions they had been supplied with, Florian traipsed boldly back at the head of his troop and inquired if dinner was ready, what. So the wandering Noonvale companions are installed in Redwall once more. Abbess Song was informed by Florian that it might take a season or three to build a new cart. We are all very fond of the old rascal. He may stay with us as long as he pleases. Logalog has taken his shrews off to see the Riverhead Waterbowl tribe, where they will learn how to construct a new fleet of boats, lighter and faster than their old logboats. I hear Burble, the Riverhead chief, is a very odd and humorous young water bull. His full title, I am told, is Chief Burble Big Throne, holder of Leafwood and commander of the boat Swallow. Dan could hardly tell me for laughing of how Burble plundered his throne from the Marl Fox's castle and insisted on bringing it back home on Gawjo's raft, polishing it the entire trip. We look forward to a visit from both Riverheads and Gwasim at our midwinter festival. What more is there to tell? Redwall's harvest is in. Days grow short, and birds are flocking together in the trees for their long flight to the sunny places.
Skipper and his otter crew are hauling in dead tree trunks from Mossflower Wood, fuel for the abbey fires. I dearly love a good fire, particularly on some cold winter night when snow is driven by howling winds outside. We sit around a cheery blaze in Cavern Hole, roasting chestnuts, singing songs, and telling tales, happy together in the warmth and safety of our beloved home, Redwall Abbey. They say our bells can be heard from afar at any time of day or night. If you are traveling across the flatlands, through the woods, or along the path, you may hear our twin bells. They will be calling you to come and join us, and we would be pleased to see you. Do call in some day. You will be made welcome by all who dwell within our walls. Rimrose Swifteye, apprentice recorder to Friar Butty, at Redwall Abbey in Mossflower Country. And never too old to learn new skills. Curtain. This narrative has been edited by Florian Dugglewolf Wilfelchop, actor-manager impresario, who insists that the entire tale is a drama, which he will be later performing as a play, hence the three parts being named as acts rather than books. We crave your indulgence for this deviation. End of Marlfox by Brian Jakes. Read by David Palmer in the studios of the American Printing House for the Blind, Louisville, Kentucky, for the Library of Congress, April 2000. Published by Philomel Books, a division of Penguin Putnam Books for Young Readers, 345 Hudson Street, New York, New York, 10014. Further reproduction or distribution in other than a specialized format is prohibited. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.
Oh, dear.